Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the July 7th and July 14th issue of the Week. This is our second reading from the July 7th, July 14th issue. And we'll get a little deeper into some of the material than we usually do. But we'll start today on the briefing page. Writers on strike. Hollywood screenwriters have been on strike for 2 months over wages and AI-generated scripts. What are the stakes? The 11,500 film and television writers in the Writers Guild of America have been on strike since the beginning of May, leading many productions to pause and live scripted programs such as late-night talk shows to go off the air. The Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, which includes studios such as Universal and Paramount and streaming services such as Netflix and Apple, objects to a union demand that shows keep a minimum number of writers on staff for a standard duration, regardless of need. The union also wants to restrict the use of artificial intelligence, AI, in creating plots and scripts, painting the dispute as an existential crisis in which the survival of writing as a profession is at stake. Compensation is another big sticking point. How much do Hollywood writers make? It varies enormously depending on experience, track record of success, and how often they work. But the current average income for Hollywood writers is $69,510 a year, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Median weekly pay for a writer-producer has declined 14% in the last 5 years, taking inflation into account. Half of TV writers are working at the minimum rate of about $4,500 a week, compared with 33% 10 years ago. Most writers only work and get paid for a portion of the year. Meanwhile, the WGA estimates that industry profits increased from $5 billion in 2000 to at least $28 billion from 2017 to 2021, with studio executives making tens of millions. The AMPTP maintains that it offered generous increases in compensation, but the WGA argues that streaming has cut into writers' residual payments for reruns. For now, negotiations have stopped. Philosophically and practically, we're very far apart, said Writers Guild negotiator Chris Kaiser. Has this happened before? Yes, there's a long history of work stoppages in Hollywood, often coinciding with major changes in the industry. The first WGA strike was in 1960, when screenwriters won the right to a share in profits when movies aired on TV. In 1973, another strike centered on the emergence of cable. The most recent strike occurred at the dawn of the streaming era in 2007. It lasted 100 days. Los Angeles economy lost an estimated $2.1 billion during that strike. What's the streaming issue now? Network shows once had 24 episodes a season, and writers were paid by the week for about 10 months per season. Streaming shows now often have as few as 8 episodes, severely limiting writers' earnings and job security. Residual payments ensured that writers profited from the continued success of their work when networks reran syndicated series. But streaming services pay writers one fixed residual fee. If you make something and a billion people watch it, you don't make more money than if it was a disaster, writer-director Judd Apatow told Variety. Writer Valentina Garza recently shared a photo of a residual check for writing 2 episodes of Jane the Virgin, which is streaming on Netflix. It totaled 3 since. Another controversial change has been using mini rooms instead of traditional writers' rooms. Mini rooms use fewer writers for less time, often finishing before production begins, cutting writers out of most of the process. Where does AI fit in? Writers fear that artificial intelligence programs like ChatGPT could start replacing them. The WGA has two demands: a guarantee that scripts can't be written or rewritten by chatbots, and an assurance that studios won't use AI to create basic plot outlines that humans will then flesh out for the screen. Guild members are concerned about what they call the Nora Ephron problem. If producers fed Ephron's many scripts into AI, it could produce a script that convincingly mimicked her work. In fact, AI could soon be writing, editing, and even directing movies from start to finish, giving instructions for shot lists and characters' movements. Maybe not next year or the year after, but if we're talking 10 years, AI is going to be able to do all of these things, said Fox Entertainment CEO Rob Wade. What do the studios say? The AMPTP insists that it made a fair offer, but rejected the writers' demands on regulating AI, countering with an offer to hold annual meetings about technological advancements. The industry group insists it respects the humanity writers bring to their work, but also is keeping its future options open. The best stories are original, insightful, and often come from people's own experiences, the group said, adding, AI raises hard, important, creative, and legal questions for everyone. Screenwriters can see the writing on the wall, said David Gunkel, a communications professor at Northern Illinois University, who researches AI's role in entertainment. AI is already displacing human labor in many other areas of content creation. The WGA is simply trying to get out in front. AI's first film. Last year, The Safe Zone became the first movie written and directed by AI. The short film depicts a dystopian future in which AI takes over the world. Its creators started by asking ChatGPT to come up with story ideas, and then fed the best ones back into the software to generate scripts. To keep it on track, they continuously reminded ChatGPT of the plot and asked detailed questions about the story. Next, they instructed the software to create a shot list and detail camera positions, props, and characters' facial expressions. The creators then fed that information into AI image generators to develop a storyboard. As filming got underway, producers repeatedly asked ChatGPT for ideas about cinematography. At this stage, human producers played a big role in directing ChatGPT's work. But AI showed it could write in minutes what human writers would need weeks to accomplish. Eventually, you'll be able to ask AI for any variation of any film you've ever wanted, said producer Aaron Kimmer. If you want to see Tom Cruise play Iron Man fighting Darth Vader, you'll be able to ask the AI to create it instantly. We'll read a few pieces from the People page. Jackson's Activist Youth. Samuel L. Jackson's life nearly went in a much different direction, said Marlo Stern in Rolling Stone. The killing of Martin Luther King Jr. helped turn him into an activist, and he served as an usher at King's funeral, held at historically black Morehouse College in Atlanta. Robert Culp and Bill Cosby rented a plane and took about 100 students from Spelman and Morehouse and Clark to Memphis to march with the garbage men, Jackson, 74, says. And then we came back and the funeral was the next day. I volunteered to do all that. Months later, he saw on TV the violent clashes between police and protesters outside the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago. Seeing the police beating those demonstrators, and those were young white kids, I learned there's a certain kind of thing that the powers that be don't want us doing, he says. Jackson had dreams of becoming an actor, but he put them aside when he got involved with Stokely Carmichael in the Black Power movement. Then the FBI knocked on his mother's door and told her something bad was going to happen to me if she didn't get me out of Atlanta in the summer of 69, Jackson says. She took him to the airport and bought him a one-way ticket to Los Angeles. I went to L.A. and became something else, he says. Why Lipko Can Laugh Amid War. Serhii Lipko is juggling two jobs, one as a Ukrainian soldier, the other as a stand-up comedian, said Yaroslav Drutsik in the New York Magazine. Lipko, 29, remains one of Ukraine's most popular comedians despite serving near the front lines in Bakhmut, where he operates military drones. Why do we do comedy, he asks. I believe it's the way to turn a problem into a joke. That's even more relevant when you're at war. Your brain wants to turn your painful experience into a joke. It will keep hurting you, so the instinct is to devalue it. So I do stand-up now basically for self-preservation. In his act, he mocks Vladimir Putin and Russian soldiers, jokes he's learning English to work with NATO instructors, and does gags about life as a newlywed. He stays away from the really dark humor of his fellow soldiers who witness death daily. Oh man, those guys are so funny. Before the war, he had hoped to tour Europe and become internationally known, but his ambition now is to survive and help Ukrainians cope. I'm just glad that even in wartime, I found another way to be useful, he says. Being able to perform stand-up in those circumstances brings me a lot of joy. It makes me feel better, at least sometimes. Don Lemon accused CNN last week of a dereliction of journalistic duty in his first interview since being fired in April after 17 years at the news network. Speaking with an ABC affiliate in Memphis, Lemon, 57, said he felt he had a responsibility to stand up for what is right at CNN, suggesting it cost him his job. In an apparent reference to the town hall that CNN recently hosted with Donald Trump, Lemon said, I don't believe in platforming liars and bigots, insurrectionists and election deniers, and putting them on the same footing as people who are telling the truth. Lemon, fired after clashing with CNN staff and female co-host Caitlin Collins and Poppy Harlow, said he's not rushing a return to television. And we'll read a couple of the short columns that we didn't get last week. This one is from Poland. Can this mini Olympics be saved? How can a major international tournament draw so little enthusiasm? Said Miroslaw Zukowski. Poland is currently hosting the European Games, a relatively new pre-Olympic competition like the Pan American or Asian Games, but without the panache. But even we don't seem excited. Part of that's because of the political stigma clinging to the European Games from its first two iterations in 2015 and 2019, which were held by the grace of the dictators of Azerbaijan and Belarus. If Russia's bid to host this year had succeeded, the whole endeavor would likely have died a natural death. Holding the 2023 Games instead in Krakow, a historic city known to every educated European, was supposed to save them. But how can it when the European Union views the Polish government almost as skeptically as it does the dictatorships? Since the ultranationalist Law and Justice Party took over in 2015, the EU has criticized it over and over, for everything from its press reforms to its political control of the judiciary. Even here at home, many see these European Games as a jingoistic boondoggle just another attempt to convince Poles that our homeland is thriving. It's too bad for the swimmers, archers, gymnasts, and other athletes, because these games are a flop. This is from Portugal. Kidnapping kids to play soccer. What kind of scum would use a boy's dream of becoming a soccer star to lure him into slavery? Asked Carlos Rodriguez. That's what's been going on right here in Portugal. Last week, at least 80 boys from South America, Africa, and Asia were rescued from a soccer training academy in Famalicão, where they were kept under lock and key, without enough food, crammed into shabby dormitories, without documents. Authorities suspect the aspiring athletes were lured to Portugal by scammers posing as agents or scouts who promised them contracts or a trial run with a club, for a pretty penny, of course. The boys were forced to work without pay and live in conditions devoid of all human dignity. This is what happens when the criminal greed of traffickers joins the blind ambition of families. Portuguese soccer bigwigs claim to be shocked by this horrific story of human trafficking, but it's difficult to imagine that nobody had noticed any funny business. A scam like this invariably involves a complex web of interest and complicity already. Maria Costa, president of Portuguese Professional Football League, has been declared a suspect and has quit his post. He is accused of attempting to sell investors on this business model of foreign talent development. Surely he's not alone. How deep will the rot go? And from Honduras, where gangs are the real authority, ferocious gangs have taken their bloody war to a woman's prison, said Jose Adan Castellar. Last week, 48 women inmates were slaughtered in a battle between the two most feared Central American gangs, MS-13 and Barrio 18. Women gang members who had managed to arm themselves with pistols and machetes set a fire as a diversion, then leaped on their rivals, hacking and shooting. Those who survived were hurled back into cells and doused with flammable liquid. Hondurans are used to riots in men's prisons, but this grisly massacre shattered expectations, not least because of the despicable and bloodthirsty behavior of women. Clearly, the gang members had also corrupted some of the prison's guards and wardens, since they were able to organize the attack and procure the weapons. Tacitly acknowledging the reality, President Xiomara Castro has now fired her security minister and promised to retake control of the prisons. But how? Our leaders in the recent past, notably former President Juan Orlando Hernandez, extradited to the U.S. last year on drug trafficking and gun charges, colluded with organized crime to contaminate the state security forces. It won't be easy to bring down the corrupt structures. Here's a couple of business articles, starting with Dark Patterns. Is it too hard to cancel Amazon Prime? Breaking up with Amazon is too hard to do, said Lucas Alpert in MarketWatch. According to a civil lawsuit filed by the Federal Trade Commission last week, Amazon customers were required to make their way through a four-page, six-click, 15-option process just to cancel a $14.99 per month Prime membership. On the other hand, signing up for Prime requires only one or two clicks. Amazon has become a poster child of the subscription economy with its Prime program. An estimated 72% of U.S. households have a membership, and it brings in $25 billion annually. Part of that success, the FTC says, can be attributed to to manipulating customers into inadvertently signing up for Prime and then making it challenging to cancel. The e-commerce giant even has an internal nickname for its labyrinthine system called the Iliad Flow, after the epically long and complex masterwork by the Greek poet Homer. Let this be a warning to other subscription-based businesses, said David Lee in Bloomberg. The kind of maneuvers outlined by the FTC are hardly unique to Amazon. Called dark patterns, they are visual or functional tweaks designed to manipulate our behavior, whether we're signing up for auto renewals, engaging with an ad, or panic booking a hotel. 31 people are looking for this room. No, they're not. Most consumers have gotten hip to these slippery practices. I even have a calendar filled with reminders to cancel free trials. Fortunately, the FTC doesn't feel the onus should be on consumers. The pressure already seems to be working, said Dalvin Brown in the Wall Street Journal. Recognizing the frustration boiling among consumers, some companies, including Netflix and Robinhood, have already started reducing the friction, even using easy cancellation as a point of differentiation. Their fear is that a difficult cancellation process will create ill will among consumers. Is a six-click cancellation process worthy of federal intervention? Asked Elizabeth Nolan Brown in Reason. The FTC doesn't seem to have looked much at its own website, which takes more clicks to post a public comment. Yes, during checkout, Amazon presents consumers with a prominent button to enroll in Prime and a comparatively inconspicuous link to decline, the FTC asserts. Does that really merit a lawsuit? Amazon even gives people a full $14.99 refund if they forgot to cancel after 30 days or didn't realize they would be auto-charged. Still, the FTC is unsatisfied. Amazon has some flaws, but the argument that it's broadly harmful to consumers is far removed from reality. A recent Morning Consult poll found Amazon to be the second most trusted brand in the United States, trailing only Band-Aid. Maybe trickery isn't the reason most Americans keep paying for their Prime membership. The Office. Companies plead for workers to come back. Stop me if you've heard this before, but businesses are ready to get serious about getting workers back to their desks, said Emma Goldberg in the New York Times. Actually, more than serious. They're desperate. After 3 years of scattershot plans for returning to in-person work, a wave of big companies, including Disney, Amazon, AT&T, and Meta, recently announced firm intentions, for real this time, to call workers back in. Employers have largely accepted that hybrid work is a permanent reality, with just over a quarter of full workdays in the country now done at home. But business leaders also say that the work-from-home experiment has made them feel emphatically that they need some in-person time. Salesforce, which in 2021 had declared the 9-to-5 workday dead, announced last month that it will give a $10 charitable donation per day for 10 days on behalf of in-office employees. Google is trying the opposite tack, announcing that it will begin tracking badge swipes and punishing workers on performance reviews for unexplained office absences. Work-from-home proponents note the 13% productivity bump early in the pandemic when offices were closed, said Allison Schrager in City Journal. But that's not sustainable. Innovation and problem-solving rely on spontaneous collaboration. In-person workers also provide valuable services like mentoring, training, and advocating for younger colleagues who get less feedback when they're working from home. Business people say this creates habits of laziness, said Samantha DeLuia in CNN.com. Take it from the still hardworking 81-year-old Martha Stewart. All of France, she reminds us, is off for August. Look at their level of success. That, Stewart reminds us, is not a very thriving country. That's just another example of the false belief that the office is the secret sauce to productivity, said Gleb Tepersky in Fortune. Since when do you get more work done in the office? As anyone who's ever worked next to a chatty colleague knows, desk jobs can be more like a productivity black hole, where focused work gets sucked into oblivion. Forcing workers back into the office is even worse for productivity. A recent Gallup study found that workers who could work remotely but are mandated to go to the office had the lowest engagement of anyone. Certainly, if you want your company to have mentoring and training opportunities, you should create mentoring programs. But mentoring won't magically happen just by packing employees into an office like sardines. The shift to remote work was inevitable, said Dror Poleg in The Atlantic. Once the quality of online collaboration crossed a crucial threshold, the Internet itself was going to become the premier facilitator of human interaction. And once white-collar workers could earn a nice living anywhere, cities were going to be in trouble. Only the speed with which this has happened was unpredictable. We're on the threshold of a major urban crisis, with offices at half occupancy and $1.5 trillion in commercial loans coming due. We need to rethink what cities are about, not try to push white-collar workers back into boxes of glass and steel. Time for the last word, our feature article. The Age of Ozempic. America has long treated obesity as a failure of will rather than a public health problem, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. New weight loss drugs might finally change that. Thinnest was not a word I was accustomed to hearing in a sentence about me. I wasn't fat, exactly, but I was awfully close. At 5 feet and 152 pounds, my body mass index was 29.2, just shy of the 30 that is considered obese. More to the point, when I emailed my doctor on that day in October 2021, I was miserable. My clothes didn't fit. Looking at myself in photos on the unfortunate occasions when I was caught on camera was painful. I had been a skinny child, but puberty wasn't kind to me. Pregnancy was bad, and menopause even worse. Weight was a chronic issue, but for the most part, not an urgent one. I was always heavier than I wanted to be, but when I put my mind to it, I could shed enough pounds to look better for a while. I will never forget the slap in the face sting of a 10th grade boyfriend who offered, in response to what I had intended as a joking inquiry, "Everyone knows you could stand to lose a few pounds." Over the years, I tried a little hypnosis and a lot of grapefruit. I attempted Scarsdale and SlimFast, counted calories and cut carbs. In college, I packed on the freshman 15 and then lost it. I was thin, or thin enough, when I met my husband a dozen years later, and thin enough at our wedding. When children arrived, so did the extra pounds. Setting up shop at the kitchen table for remote work during the pandemic didn't help. So at 63, I was stuck and unhappy. This time, I just couldn't seem to get my appetite under control, I told my doctor, Beth Horowitz. A close friend, another patient of hers, had been seriously obese. Since we met nearly four decades ago, my friend had tried everything. Liquid diets, bariatric surgery, you name it. Nothing worked, or, more accurately, nothing worked for long. But now, with a diabetes drug called Ozempic, my friend had lost 75 pounds. slowly over the course of more than a year. This may sound crazy, I asked Beth, but could this work for me? A few weeks later, I unwrapped my periwinkle blue Ozempic pen, screwed on the tiny needle, and turned the dial to 0.25. A tiny droplet of clear liquid appeared at the tip. I jabbed it into my abdomen. Calling this an injection overstates things. It's a teeny, painless pinprick, especially painless if you've got the body fat to justify it. As I write this, I have lost 40 pounds, an astonishing quarter of my body weight. I weigh less than I have since high school. At this point, I should interject. Novo Nordisk, the manufacturer of Ozempic, is clear that this medication has not been approved for weight loss, although the company's ubiquitous cable ads, Ozempic, happen to mention that topic. Adults lost up to 14 pounds three times in the course of a minute, and physicians are free to prescribe Ozempic off-label for a use other than its official purpose. Ozempic is just part of a new arsenal of medications. In June 2021, the Food and Drug Administration gave the go-ahead to an identical formulation at higher doses and at a higher price under the name Wegovy, another diabetes medication. Tirzepatide, marketed under the brand name Mounjaro, has demonstrated even more dramatic weight loss results. 22.5% on average versus 15% with Wegovy. And the FDA is expected to formally approve its use to treat obesity. I think this is the turning point, said Dr. George A. Bray, a veteran in the field of obesity research. It's the equivalent of bariatric surgery, but without the surgery. This is a remarkable development given the astonishing prevalence of obesity, especially in the United States, where more than 40% of adults are obese and an additional 30% are overweight. And given the failure of measures to less drastic than bariatric surgery to produce lasting results. But with this accomplishment comes a complex tapestry of moral, scientific, and economic questions. In the 14th century, Dante condemned the third cycle of hell, those who fall prey to the pernicious sin of gluttony. In the 21st, do we still think of obesity as a personal failing, evidence of lack of adequate self-control about how much to eat, and self-discipline about how vigorously to exercise? Or is obesity a disease, a chronic condition, much like high blood pressure or elevated cholesterol, whose prevalence and severity have underpinnings in genetics and brain chemistry and are largely outside individual control? The medical and scientific consensus has settled on the latter understanding, particularly since 1994, when Rockefeller University molecular geneticist Jeffrey M. Friedman identified leptin, a hormone secreted by fat cells that regulates appetite and body weight. Still, there remains little doubt that being overweight continues to subject people to judgment and to stigma. I experienced this myself as I began taking Ozempic. Intellectually, I get it. I'm more disposed than many others to gain weight, and after I lose weight, my body wants to return to a higher set point. Yet as my weight loss began to show and people started to ask how I was doing it, I realized that I had internalized the sense that being heavy was a failing for which I was personally responsible. Sometimes, when I wasn't up to being fully transparent, I would share a pallid version of the truth, saying simply that I ate less. That was technically true, but fundamentally misleading. And why? No one with diabetes would balk at acknowledging they treated it with insulin or high cholesterol with statins. Other times I would offer a fuller explanation, one even more revealing of my discomfort with the frame of obesity as disease. I cheated, I would confess. I took this new medication. Again, the diabetes analogy. No one thinks taking insulin is cheating. They recognize that it's a treatment for a medical condition. But I had, and I suspect I'm not alone, a deep-rooted sense that losing weight should be accompanied by suffering, a reverse no pain, no gain mentality. People still believe that it's a personal choice and a lifestyle choice that somebody makes, and this is at fault for their obesity, said Dr. Scott Butch, director of obesity medicine at the Bariatric and Metabolic Institute of the Cleveland Clinic. And the problem is that people who have these beliefs are everywhere. Physicians, dietitians, school teachers, people who work on policy issues. So when you multiply the decision makers and those who still have the belief that obesity is not a disease and is a lifestyle problem, you realize what we're up against when it comes to trying to make large changes in our healthcare system. Almost immediately after my first injection of Ozempic, I felt a bit queasy, like suffering from car sickness after a bumpy ride. I vomited several times after eating too much or too fast. Those effects mostly disappeared, but other gastrointestinal consequences remained. With apologies if this is too much information. Constipation, sometimes followed by diarrhea. But while some people experience severe and even intolerable side effects, mine were minor, manageable, and for the most part, fleeting. What I also experienced and what remains is an unfamiliar feeling. Satiety, my relationship with hunger, and therefore with eating, is transformed. I leave food on my plate, untouched and unlamented, and do not look at the food on yours with those same longing. Are you going to eat those fries? I can, it turns out, stop after just a few Thin Mints. And my taste buds appear to have shifted. I would rather have the roasted Brussels sprouts than the burger, which isn't going to sit all that well in my stomach. The weight came off slowly, which I knew was the best way to lose it. Some weeks just a pound, some weeks nothing. Rarely anything more. I gradually ramped up the dosage as suggested, from 0.25 to 0.5 milligrams weekly. And then, in March 2022, when the weight loss had plateaued at about 15 pounds, increased to a higher capacity pen, 1 milligram per injection, I've remained at this level since. My appetite has returned somewhat. At times, I am hungry again, and that feels oddly unwelcome because it is controlled hunger, not insatiable craving. Somehow, I can stop myself from reaching for another piece of bread. My weight loss has slowed. Depending on the day, I'm down a pound or two this year, and that's fine. The critical question is whether, for the first time in my life, I will be able to maintain this weight. I cannot claim to have done this for my health. Certainly, appearance was my primary motivation, but the health impact has been impressive. My sleep apnea had been so severe that tests showed I was waking up an alarming 54 times every hour. Now testing put it in the mild range, and my sleep apnea machine has been stashed in the closet. Then there is the emotional impact, harder to quantify, but equally important. I understand the movement for body positivity and fat acceptance, and if you are heavy and content with your weight, that's terrific. No one should feel externally imposed shame about how they look. But speaking for myself, I am so much happier being thinner. Shopping for clothes is no longer a humiliating ordeal. Ordering dessert does not feel like a contest between gluttony and shame. In the opening scene of the movie The Whale, a morbidly obese Brendan Fraser is teaching an online writing class. On his Zoom display, a black square labeled instructor sits in the midst of a sea of student faces. This encapsulates the experience of obesity, the shame at being seen, an aversion to seeing yourself. For all the encouraging talk about body positivity, This is the reality for millions of people, myself included. You don't have to look like a whale to feel like one. Obesity medications empower us to be seen in the Zoom square. After a year and a half on Ozempic, I find myself both exhilarated and unsettled by this prospect. How amazing is it that millions of people who have endured the misery of struggling with their weight now have what appears to be a safe and effective way to address it? We are at the start of a brave new world when it comes to treating obesity. One sign of the new "if you can't beat 'em" reality came in March, when Weight Watchers bought a telehealth company that provides obesity drugs. This is big business, with billions to be made in selling obesity medications to a market that is enormous, growing, and largely untapped. Even based on conservative assumptions about what percentage of those eligible would sign up and how long they would stay on the medications, the market could reach $54 billion in 2030, the investment bank Morgan Stanley estimates, up from $2.4 billion today. And that also leaves me unsettled. In a just society with a rational allocation of resources, I would not be anywhere near the front line to obtain a medication that is prohibitively expensive and, at least until recently, in short supply. Neither would the attractive folks in Hollywood, nor many of the other people I know who are taking it. If you can't be too rich or too thin, it turns out, you might have to be rich to be thin. The racial disparities in obesity and access make matters even worse. And we are only starting to consider questions about what constitutes appropriate use. For the seriously obese, the case seems clear. Leaving aside the important questions of cost, and prices will come down, certainly as patent protections expire, where to draw the line? If this medication is safe and effective, why not prescribe it for the merely overweight, even without an associated medical issue? And why not for the bride who wants to drop 10 pounds before her wedding day? She might gain the weight back, but would it really be so terrible? Still, to take up the other side of that argument, what role does this leave for instilling habits of self-discipline, encouraging healthy eating, and incorporating exercise? The experts can preach about the importance of accompanying use with a program of diet and exercise. We know what will happen in the real world. The genie isn't going back in the bottle, nor should she. We need to embark on a serious conversation, not about what these medications mean for celebrities on Instagram, but what their arrival signifies for the rest of us, struggling and imperfect. This was adapted from an article that originally appeared in the Washington Post. Here's a technology article that will follow with a couple of health and science pieces. Moguls, two tech titans, bare teeth, and flex abs. It's come to this. Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg said they want to fight each other in a cage match, said Wizzy Kim and Nicole Naria in Vox. We seriously doubt this will actually happen, despite the back-and-forth social media banter last week between two of the world's richest men. Musk first floated the idea of a cage match, yes, an actual Ultimate Fighting Championship-style slugfest, in a tweet after Zuckerberg's company Meta announced it was launching an app to rival Twitter. Zuckerberg, who has been training in jiu-jitsu with a top coach, responded tersely with, "Send me the location." There is a history of animosity between the two men, but the absurd idea of a fight just seems to be a reflection of their sheer vanity. It's a shared plea for attention from two boys who also know that when the attention is on them and they go viral, that usually makes them richer and more influential. There is legitimately bad blood between these two, said Eric Berger in Ars Technica. This dispute can be tracked back 7 years when a satellite that Zuckerberg was leasing blew up on a launch on a SpaceX rocket. Zuckerberg publicly blamed SpaceX, angering Musk and others at the company. A couple of years later, Musk deleted the Facebook pages for SpaceX and Tesla, saying they looked lame anyway. The proposed fight harks back to the example of Southwest Airlines chief Herb Keller, who settled a business dispute by arm wrestling a rival in front of an audience at a Dallas arena in the early 1990s, said Tim Higgins and Deepa Sitharaman in the Wall Street Journal. That fight was prearranged, however, whereas this one seems a bit more personal. Musk has for years privately brooded that Zuckerberg made so much money so easily with software while he toiled away on cars and rockets. While Zuckerberg has harbored jealousy over the esteem that Musk received as an innovator. Zuckerberg also envies Twitter's influence, said John Herman in New York Magazine. For all its massive success, Facebook never had a product with Twitter's particular relationship to elite power structures. Twitter never turned into a Facebook-scale business, but its simple real-time feed carried outsized importance among celebrities, journalists, politicians, and people like Donald Trump and Elon Musk. Now, with Musk running Twitter's business in new and unpredictable directions, Meta finally sees an opening to replace what Twitter did best. Tech icons used to be dorky, said Grace Key in Business Insider. Think Bill Gates or Larry Page. Now they're getting shredded, ripping edgy jokes, embracing a culture of hypermasculinity. Musk and Zuckerberg's posturing confirms every fraternity brother stereotype. And finally, brought us to peak brotech. The cancer drug shortage. A shortage of generic drugs used to treat many cancers has gotten so bad that doctors are rationing care, reports Scientific American. There's little money in generics, and competition from middlemen has driven costs down even lower over the past 5 years. That has pushed production of cisplatin and carboplatin, two drugs that have been used for decades to treat breast, cervical, bladder, ovarian, lung, testicular, and other cancers, overseas to plants that FDA inspectors rarely visit. Last November, the FDA did assess the Intas Pharmaceuticals plant near Ahmedabad, India, which provides more than half the U.S. supply of both drugs, and found shocking lapses in quality control, prompting the company to close the plant. Since then, pharmacists have been unable to source the drugs that thousands of patients desperately need. More drug shortages could well follow. Fully one quarter of all U.S. drug prescriptions are filled by companies that have received FDA warning letters in the past 2 years. For the two cancer drugs, the shortage is already forcing doctors to treat patients with just 80% of the optimal dose, in some cases 60%. Health advocacy groups are now pushing for government subsidies to make generics manufacturing profitable in the U.S. At a certain point, says Alan Kokol of the nonprofit Civica RX, the system needs to recognize there's a high cost to low cost drugs. Catastrophic ice melt. Himalayan glaciers are melting at the fastest rate ever seen. They could lose as much as 50% of their ice by the end of this century, a new study says, which would put much of Asia at risk of avalanches, catastrophic flooding, and water shortages. Researchers from the International Center for Integrated Mountain Development examined the Hindu Kush region of the Himalayas, a vast area stretching from Afghanistan to Myanmar that contains the largest volume of ice concentration outside the poles. The region is also a source of 12 rivers that provide water for nearly 2 billion people, The researchers found that glaciers there had melted 65% faster between 2010 and 2019 than in the previous decade. Even if global warming is capped at 1.5 degrees Celsius, which few believe is in reach, one-third of those glaciers will be permanently lost. At 2 degrees, half will disappear. That loss will have a devastating impact on the hundreds of millions of people who depend on yearly snowmelt for their water supply. They'll face not only water shortages, but also extreme weather events and floods that wipe out crops. And the resulting food shortages will cause mass migration. This is a clarion call, co-author Philippus Wester told CBS News. We need to seriously commit to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Giant snail invasion in Florida. Floridians, watch out. The giant African land snail has been spotted near Fort Lauderdale. The U.S. Agriculture Department calls the banana-sized behemoth one of the most damaging snails in the world, and for good reason. The animals eat everything in sight, from the stucco and plaster on your house to any of 500 different plant species, which means they can wreak havoc on farms. Worse, they carry diseases and parasites, such as salmonella and rat lungworm, which can cause meningitis. Parts of Broward County were placed under snail quarantine this month, which means nobody can move soil, compost, or building materials, or, of course, snails, in or out of the affected area without a permit. The snails are an enormous nuisance, biologist Robert Cowie of the University of Hawaii tells the Washington Post, in terms of eating all your plants in your yard, climbing up the walls of your house, pooping everywhere. They just make a mess. The snails are endemic in Hawaii, but Florida has eradicated them twice before, in 1975 and 2021. And we'll flip on over to the Talking Points page. The Titan, Why the Global Fascination. For 5 years, the avid explorer who served as CEO of OceanGate Expeditions ignored urgent safety warnings about his experimental new submersible, the Titan, said Nicholas Bogleburrows in the New York Times. Last week, a frantic hunt for the missing submersible near the wreckage of the Titanic in the Atlantic ended when an international search revealed that the Titan's hull had imploded more than 2 miles down, instantly killing CEO Stockton Rush and 4 paying passengers. Rush had been charging wealthy adventurers up to $250,000 apiece to see the Titanic, in a craft whose hull was mostly made of lighter, less expensive carbon fibers instead of thick steel or titanium. In a 2018 letter, 38 deep-sea explorers and other experts warned Rush that his refusal to have the Titan rigorously tested and certified could lead to a catastrophic failure at greater depth. But Rush dismissed those and other expressions of concern, saying the industry standards were stifling innovation. Rush clearly is responsible for his passengers' deaths, said Sam Howe Verhovic in the Washington Post. But the vilification of him is cartoonishly one-dimensional. The Wright brothers, Charles Lindbergh, and Neil Armstrong all took frightful risks that could have easily ended in disaster as in triumph. Sorry, said Tim Malton in MSNBC.com. But none of those pioneers brought along adventure tourists. In Rush's case, that included a Pakistani businessman and his 19-year-old son, who may have signed the required waiver, but believed they were coming back. Their deaths are tragic, said Katerina Min in Scientific American. But what about the boat full of migrants that sank in the Mediterranean a week earlier? killing at least 600 human beings. It's telling that a few wealthy adventurers generated such a global attention and sympathy, while the drownings of so many desperate people fleeing war and poverty drew a collective shrug. Yes, but there's a reason the Titan had a chokehold on the global consciousness, said Raven Smith in Vogue. Before its fate was known, we could all imagine the visceral horror of being crammed into a tiny pod running out of oxygen. Then there was the connection to the ill-fated voyage of the Titanic, a cautionary tale for the ages of mankind's belief in science dominating nature. More than a century later, that hubris was eerily repeated at the same spot in the Atlantic. On the poll watch, 49% of Americans think Hunter Biden received favorable treatment from prosecutors on his tax evasion and gun case because he's President Biden's son, including 75% of Republicans, 42% of independents, and 33% of Democrats. 58% of all Americans say Hunter Biden's legal troubles will have no impact on whether they will vote for Joe Biden in 2024. And we'll finish today with a quote from Nelson Mandela, who says, "There can be no keener revelation of a society's soul than the way in which it treats its children." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.